For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Ollie Barrett. Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip are holding a day of strikes and protests after US President Donald Trump moved to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Israel's welcomed the decision as historic and says other nations are considering following suit. But Saudi Arabia, France and the UK are among US allies criticizing President Trump's actions. London Mayor Sadiq Khan, who's fallen out with Donald Trump on several occasions, was asked about the decision while in Islamabad.
My worry is what it leads to is that people around the world, in particular in Muslim-majority countries, thinking that President Trump is acting in a way that's deliberately unhelpful and not leading to a peaceful settlement in that part of the world. And, you know,
do you think it's warmongering?
Well, anybody who understands how you get to a two-state solution, who understands how part of that negotiation involves Jerusalem, understands that actually it must be in everyone's interest for there to be a two-state solution, will ask questions about why President Trump has said what he did.
The UK says it's optimistic a deal can be reached to satisfy both sides of the Irish border as the issue remains an obstacle to returning to a Brexit deal. Negotiations are continuing between Prime Minister Theresa May's Conservative government and its parliamentary allies, the Democratic Unionist Party, in a bid to reach agreement. From London, Catherine Drew.
With the final EU Council summit of the year just a week away, British Prime Minister Theresa May continues to scramble to find a Brexit deal that satisfies both Northern Ireland and Ireland. The latter has threatened to veto any deal that means a return to a hard border. However, the DUP says it cannot accept any deal which means Northern Ireland leaves the European Union on different terms to the rest of the UK. However, the British government says it is optimistic that a compromise will be reached. EU leaders hope to have this matter resolved by Friday, so the bloc can discuss whether to move talks on to a second phase, which will define the UK's future trade relationship with the European Union. Some Eurosceptic Conservatives have been urging Mrs. May to leave the European Union without a deal. However, a new report from the House of Lords describes that scenario as deeply damaging and concludes it will be difficult, if not impossible, to envisage a worst outcome for Britain.
A baby wrongly declared dead by a hospital in Delhi has died. The parents claim the hospital told them their twin babies were stillborn and handed over the bodies, but the family later discovered one of the babies was still breathing. Rebecca Bunden reports.
The premature baby in India's capital, who had reportedly been declared dead by one hospital, has passed away after being treated in another hospital. The boy was pronounced dead on November 30th, but the parents discovered that he was alive when they were on their way to the funeral, they say. Two doctors have been fired from the hospital following an inquiry. Rebecca Bunden, Mumbai.
Same-sex marriage has been approved by Australia's House of Representatives and will become legal in the country. Australia's Governor-General will approve the bill within days. From Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN.
Thanks very much, Ollie. Welcome to Thursday's Richie Allen Show in association with davidicke.com. Live on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester and TuneIn Radio as well. Always good to be with you. What is it, the 7th? It is the 7th of December 2017. Let's do it.
Broadcasting live from the great city of Manchester, England. This is the Richie Allen Show on davidicke.com. The Richie Allen Show, brought to you in association with davidicke.com. And now, live from Manchester, England, here is Richie Allen.
Right, I've got a very good show lined up for you this Thursday. I'm only joking. Kevin Myers, the journalist and author, joins the program in the second hour, recently fired by the Sunday Times after he wrote a very thought-provoking article about the gender pay gap at the BBC. Anti-Semitism and all of that. Kevin joins us in the second hour. It's going to be interesting. And coming up before that in hour one, the former US Assistant Treasury Secretary Paul Craig Roberts, also former editor of the Wall Street Journal. Paul joins us live from Virginia. We love Paul Craig Roberts. Looking forward to hearing what he makes of the announcement by Donald Trump yesterday that the United States will recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. We'll talk about Michael Flynn as well and much more with PCR, who joins me this hour. Coming up for 4.5 minutes past the hour. Welcome live on As I said, davidicke.com, fabradio2, bookmark davidicke.com, because a lot of very, very interesting info is shared on that website daily. Welcome. Tweet me. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Tweet at Richie Allen Show if you've got an opinion on anything. Now, it's being reported that at least 31 Palestinians have been wounded in clashes in Gaza and across the occupied West Bank. This is in the wake of Donald Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. One person reports the BBC is in a critical condition. Trump's announcement, which was met with worldwide dismay, reversed decades of US policy on this issue, as you know. Israel deployed hundreds of extra troops in the West Bank as Palestinians went on strike and took to the streets. They set tires on fire and threw stones, according to the BBC, and Israeli troops fired tear gas, rubber bullets and live bullets. Typical restrained response by the Israeli Defence Forces there. The Israeli army alleged that two rockets were fired from the Gaza Strip, but fell short. That hasn't been substantiated by any media organisation. And in Gaza, according to Reuters news agency, Palestinians throwing stones were fired upon by Israeli soldiers using live ammunition. Again, typically restrained and moderate response by the Israeli army. Now, I was going to play you a very interesting report by Caleb Maupin from RT, which is a report about the very, very interesting ties between Donald Trump, historically, his team and his son-in-law and Israel. We heard from Max Blumenthal on the programme last night, but I'm not going to play you that clip today because it's just repeating what we already know, and that is Trump is heavily compromised, he's leveraged, and ultimately, the White House is controlled by Zionists. It is. Blumenthal said as much yesterday, and Caleb Maupin, reporting from New York today, says more or less the same. The interesting, the irony is that a lot of focus is being given to allegations that Russia and the Trump team are in cahoots before last year's presidential election to somehow sway the American people and influence the election. But no media organisation outside of Russia Today and independent media like this wants to ask questions about Israeli and Zionist influence inside the White House because it is total. Right? Right. But I'm going to leave that. And I'm going to leave the other main headlines because before we get Paul Craig Roberts on, I want to talk about something astonishing. Gilad Atzmon, the Israeli-born jazz saxophonist, very successful musician and public speaker, got in touch with us overnight. And he said that Jason Schumann, the journalist, had sent a Freedom of Information request to Derbyshire police to see the correspondence between the Derbyshire police and the so-called charity, the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism. What did Jason Schumann want to see? Well, he wanted to see correspondence relating to accusations made by the CAA against the musician and comedian Alison Chablow. Now, Alison is the first person to be prosecuted as a result of complaints made by the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism. She's been on this programme twice talking about this. My conversations with her are on our YouTube channel if anybody wants to hear them. They are unedited on our YouTube channel. So the Derbyshire police responded and sent some of the correspondence between the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism and the Derbyshire police. And here's a little bit of an email from Gideon Falter, the main man, the head honcho, the chief cook and bottle washer at the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism. So Falter wrote to Hardial Dinza. Now, Hardial Dinza is the Police and Crime Commissioner for Derbyshire. On June the 8th, 2016, Falter writes, "We have attempted to report this matter to Derbyshire Constabulary through normal channels. I have twice emailed the Chief Constable's office and we have also sought the help of ACC Gary Shewan, NPCC lead on anti-Semitism. I have forwarded the most recent email to ACC Shewan below, which includes an attachment containing full details of the case against Alison Chablow. The suspect in this case, Alison, a resident of Derbyshire, is suspected of being a member of a particularly prolific incitement ring. Alison is well known amongst the Jewish community through her persistent work on Twitter and YouTube to incite hatred against Jewish people. For example, she is now taken to producing songs intended to be grossly offensive to Jewish people whilst inciting hatred against them. Jewish people see this and are shocked that she remains at liberty, whilst other anti-Semites see her work and assume that they can behave in the same way without regard for the law. Having discussed progress to date and reviewed the case file with Stephen Silverman, our investigation lead, I am concerned the Derbyshire Constabulary has mismanaged the investigation. I am concerned that this investigation into an ongoing series of racially aggravated crimes will now fail. Right? That was Falter. By the way, when Falter says that, that Jewish people are very concerned, he doesn't refer to any Jewish men and women specifically, because he can't. Because most, if not all, Jewish people have no interest in this sort of nonsense. This is a Zionist campaign group which was launched around about the time Operation Protective Edge was happening in Gaza, and 2,000 Gazans, including 500 children, were being bombed to pieces by the Israeli Defence Forces. This group has ties to the Israeli embassy in the UK. They don't represent Jewish people at all. They are a hateful, tyrannical, fascist group called the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism. And here they are asking for a woman to be locked up, making all sorts of allegations about her, that she's trying to incite hatred against Jews and all of that, with no evidence whatsoever. We challenged Alison Chablow on this programme about the videos and the songs that she'd written. Those interviews are on YouTube. I saw those videos and those songs. There's nothing hateful about them. Now, Falter's email was acknowledged and he was told it was being investigated. So skip on then from June last year to May this year. Stephen Silverman of the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism. These are a double act, Silverman and Falter. They're a bit like the two Muppets who sat in the Royal Box in the Muppet Show, proper Muppets. And Silverman is described as the Director of Investigations and Enforcement. Now, I'll pause while you laugh. Silverman is a world-class Muppet. Enforcement. Police. Police, right? Anyway, Silverman sends an aggressive email to Hardy Aldinza's office, effectively demanding to know why Alison Chablow isn't in custody. Dear Mr. Dinza, I am writing to you following the failure of Derbyshire Police and the Crown Prosecution Service to enforce bail conditions against Alison Chablow, a right-wing extremist and anti-Semite who is currently on bail awaiting trial for alleged offences under Section 127, blah, blah, blah. I would be grateful if you would review the attached letter as a matter of urgency. Right? Now, the attached letter allegedly had evidence proving Alison was in breach of bail conditions and needed to be sent to jail immediately. Now again, Derbyshire Police respond. Silverman is reminded that the matter is with the Crown Prosecution Service. The respondent, a woman, expresses sympathy with Silverman that Alison is allegedly still rampaging up and down the country offending Jews. And she assures Silverman that his new evidence will be forwarded on. This is not good enough for Silverman, who is the dizziest of all these clowns, because he flies into a rage and he writes to Hardy Aldinza several days later and demands that Alison Chablow be locked up. Right? Dear Mr. Silverman, sorry that this is still going on. Thank you for your new evidence. We'll forward this on. It's with the CPS. Wah! That's not good enough. Several days later, he writes, lock her up. Lock her up. He writes that Alison is violating her bail conditions all the time, and yet she remains free to target British Jews. Lock her up. He writes, it is an outrage that Chablo is free. Jews now know, he writes, that people can do and say what they want. Remember, neither he nor Giddy Falter represent Jews. They have no interest in Jews. And sadly for these idiots, we at the Richie Allen Show have a long and fruitful relationship with prominent Jewish businessmen in Manchester. Who've never heard of these guys? Nobody has, right? They're not representing Jews. They are tyrants. He writes, it's an outrage that Chablo is free. Lock her up, lock her up, lock her up. All of these emails are available on davidicke.com, by the way. The tone, the aggressive manner with which he addresses the police and crime commissioner Hardy Aldinsa and Derbyshire is an outrage on its own. A few weeks later, the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, well, they receive an email from David Peat, and he is the chief executive for the police and crime commissioner, Mr. Hardy Aldinsa. And he writes, Mr. Dinsa has asked me to contact you about the research you have carried out showing that a third of British Jews have considered emigrating as a result of concerns about anti-Semitic crime. In addition to his role as PCC for Derbyshire, Mr. Dinsa is also the PCC national lead on hate crime, and he would be very interested in meeting with someone from your organisation to better understand the issues and see if there is anything he may be able to do to raise awareness of the issue with his fellow PCCs and more widely. If someone could get back in touch, I would be most grateful. Do you know what happened then? Hardy Aldinsa and David Peat went off to be re-educated, nay, groomed by the CAA and their chums in London. They had a re-education day where they were told about the plight of the beleaguered UK Jewish community and what needs to be done to stop people targeting them. Even though there's no evidence whatsoever that anti-Semitism is on the rise in this country. In fact, all the evidence, including prominent Jewish groups, as we've demonstrated on this programme, have come forward to say it just ain't happening. It just ain't happening. Because it isn't. Because people don't care. Am I saying that Orthodox Jews are not sometimes sworn at by people and shouted at? No, I'm not. Of course that goes on. There are Muppets everywhere. But there isn't a deeply rooted hatred of Jews in the UK that's growing and growing and growing. It ain't happening. So Hardy Aldinsa and David Peat went off to be re-educated by the CAA and their clown friends. And when they got back, they wrote to the CAA. David Peat wrote to Stephen Silverman. Listen to the email. Stephen, just wanted to email you to pass on Hardy Al and my thanks for putting together an amazing day for us yesterday. Each set of speakers gave us greater insight into the issues facing members of the Jewish community, and I have to say that on a personal level, I was shocked by what I was hearing, especially the input from the students facing anti-Semitism on campus. It is certainly going to go down as one of the days of my career that I will not be forgetting in a hurry. I don't have contact details for all those we met. If you are able to share them, that would be great so we can thank them personally. Otherwise, we would be most grateful if you could pass on our thanks once again. Both Hardy Al and I will be reflecting on what we have heard, and we will see how we can best turn discussions like this into action. We will be trying to get a slot on a forthcoming APCC general meeting agenda so that Hardy Al can share what he has heard with other PCCs across the country. And we have the germs of some ideas of how we might be able to raise the issue of anti-Semitism on other agendas. I may well be back in touch about these in the future. If there is anything in the future that you think that we might be able to assist with, or issues that you would like to be shared with the wider PCC cohort, please do not hesitate to get in touch, and we will be delighted to see how we might be able to help. Kind regards, David. Pull your tongue out of Silverman's arsehole, David. Nicely groomed now and re-educated are the Police and Crimes Commissioner for Derbyshire Police and his chief executive. What does that mean legally? Well, if I was the brief of Alison Chablo, I would be contacting Derbyshire Police as well as the media to ask what any of that has to do with Alison Chablo's case, let alone her bail conditions. If I was the brief of Alison Chablo, I would be contacting the Derbyshire Police to tell them to terminate any and all investigations into the conduct of Alison Chablo. I would ask them to launch an immediate investigation into the conduct of their police and crime commissioner Hardy Aldinsa and his friend David Peat. They need to immediately throw out the investigation because it has been horribly compromised. Any judge worth his or her salt would chuck it in the bin. And then I would be writing to the Charity Commission of the United Kingdom to ask them to remind them that they need to delist this horrible little band of thugs that is the campaign against anti-Semitism. And finally, dear listener, I shouldn't be telling you this. You should be reading it across the UK media today and tomorrow, and it should be all over the telly. But it won't be, because there isn't a journalist in the country with the spine to take these tyrants on. This is Thursday's Richie Allen Show, live on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2 and TuneIn Radio. Back in a minute.
Is your mind full of ideas, yet you struggle to put them down on paper? Characters with no home, unfinished concepts that you always wanted to finalise, yet lacked knowledge and drive to complete? The Creative Writing Course from Creative Imaginings may be the long-awaited answer. Designed to help you finish your masterpiece with better language techniques, detailed study of the character, plotted suspense chain, and valuable information to get published. Don't delay your creation. Complete your 100% online course at creativeimaginings.com.au.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Book launches are often hyped. Then you open the first page and... But David Icke's new book, Everything You Need to Know But Have Never Been Told, really will astonish you. Thought-provoking and controversial. It's available now, so read a real page-turner. Everything You Need to Know But Have Never Been Told by former footballer and presenter David Icke. Available exclusively at davidicke.com.
Right, welcome back to the programme. 24 minutes past the hour. This is your Richie Allen Show, live on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2 and TuneIn Radio. It is Thursday, December 7th, 2017. Always good to have your company. Keep the tweets coming in. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter for your comments. Our first guest today is no stranger to you whatsoever. Remarkable man. Always great to have him on. Former editor, of course, of the Wall Street Journal. former US Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. You can read him every day at paulcraigroberts.org. paulcraigroberts.org. I recommend you bookmark the website and keep an eye out for his very, very challenging, thought-provoking and well-briefed articles. Let's welcome him back to the programme. Paul, welcome back. How are you?
Okay, Richie, you hear me all right?
I'm hearing you good. Yeah, I know you're on a mobile device, but it sounds good, Paul. Thank you. You sound really good.
Okay.
So that's good. First things first, Paul, I suppose we weren't surprised to hear the US president announce yesterday that the United States would recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. So straight into that, what did you make of that, the timing of it, and the reaction that we've seen to it since? What are your thoughts?
Well, I don't know much about it, Rich. I can only speculate. I think that Trump wants to stay in the good graces of the Israel lobby because they are very powerful politically in the United States. And Trump is under attack from so many quarters that if he doesn't have the Israel lobby in on his side, he's dead meat. So I would speculate that he is doing everything he can to make himself valuable to the Israel lobby because he's purchasing their protection. That's my guess as to what's going on. Of course, you know his family is married in to the Jews, and so that gives another sort of in. So I think that would be the best bet. I don't think it's based on him wanting to antagonize the Arabs and the Muslims and all the rest. I think he is under tremendous pressure. They're trying to get rid of him with a special prosecutor. He's constantly subject to criticism, ridicule. They have pressured General Flynn into a plea bargain, which often means he then has to testify against their real target, which is not Flynn, it's Trump. So that's my best bet. He's now got the Israel lobby in his corner, and they will be a good source of protection.
Max Blumenthal, speaking to RT on Monday, said that the real story is right under the noses of Western media, and that is the Israeli influence in the Trump White House. And Blumenthal, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he went as far as suggesting that basically Jared Kushner is handling Trump for the Israeli lobby in the White House. And while the big story has been, and it never ends, collusion between Trump and the Russians, or Trump's team and the Russians, the real story of collusion is the extent of the control that the Zionist government of Israel has over Trump through Jared Kushner, whose ties with Bibi Netanyahu go back forever and a day, as you and I know. Is Blumenthal right? Is Trump being handled by the Israeli government through Kushner?
I think that's silly. The Israel lobby controls all the governments. They don't need somebody inside the White House to do it. They control the Congress. Anytime the Israel lobby wants it, Congress passes it unanimously. I think that's silly. The Israel lobby, they have such enormous influence and control, they don't need to have a Trump's son-in-law controlling him. I think the explanation I gave makes far more sense. Why would Trump's son-in-law want to get him into a bunch of trouble with everybody else? Because America's allies are critical of this. It's against legal situation of Jerusalem. Yeah. It's against the UN. So why would his son-in-law want to ruin his father-in-law? He wouldn't. And so I think Trump is doing it for the reason I said. I can't prove that. I would not bet my life on it. But I think he's telling the military security complex, okay, I've got Israel and Mossad in my corner now.
You know what's interesting, Paul?
If you guys are going to assassinate me, Mossad's probably going to tell me, because we all know Mossad has penetrated the CIA. CIA's been worried about that forever, and they can't do anything about it. So I think he's just protecting himself. I mean, who else is on his side? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's my view, but I can't say that Blumenthal is right or wrong. I can just make my own speculation, which I did.
Well, you're always fair in saying that. And what I think, my thinking is generally kind of aligned with yours. But on this issue, and again, taking my lead from you, I can't prove it either. But I think that Trump has been beholden to Zionists for many, many, many years financially through various deals. I mean, any summary examination of the financial affairs of Donald Trump over 30 years, he's up to his neck in it with financiers and banks. And I just think, Paul, I understand why it mightn't seem logical that his own son-in-law could be working against him. But we also know that the Israelis, Zionists, let's call them Zionists, they couldn't give a damn about Trump in the long term. And they don't care about what damage they might do to Trump in terms of his own political future or his legacy, so long as they get what they want, which is war with Iran, you know, and further expansion of Israel. So I take a different line on it than you. I think they do own Trump, but again, it's just my opinion. That's all it is. You know, I respect your opinion on it as well. These are interesting times, Paul. On the Flynn thing, is it a real concern for people that because of the pressure General Michael Flynn is under, that he'll be coerced into telling the FBI things that are untrue? What do you think, Paul?
Well, that's generally what happens when a federal or any prosecutor, but especially a federal prosecutor. That's generally what happens. They bring all kinds of false charges against you. Your lawyer tells you, well, you know, juries are not very clever and they believe where there's smoke, there's fire, and you'll get convicted of something for sure. So let me make a deal for you, and you'll get off light more lightly than if you actually go to trial. That's the general way it proceeds. And so when the prosecutor says, okay, we'll give you a slap on the wrist, but you've got to deliver to us so-and-so. That's the way American justice works. That's the only way it works. So, yes, there's that possibility. On the other hand, it's come out that Mueller, who's the special prosecutor, is now accused of covering up various aspects of the FBI's misbehavior. The Wall Street Journal editorial board has signed an editorial demanding that he step down because he's unfit for the job. So Mueller himself now is a target. So, and if you look at Flynn, it seems to me all he did was perfectly normal, rational, required. He told the Russian ambassador or whoever he's accused of speaking to please not overreact to the new round of sanctions that Obama had just put on Russia, because Obama was doing that to make it impossible for Trump to normalize relations with Russia. So Flynn asked them not to overreact. And of course, they didn't. So that's all he did. So to try to make a crime out of it that he didn't tell the FBI the complete truth about who he talked to or when. That's nonsense. It's got nothing to do with the Russiagate hoax. As William Binney, the scientist who designed the National Security Agency's universal spy program, thinking it would not be used against American citizens, as Binney himself has said on a number of occasions, if there was a Russiagate, the National Security Agency would have it in its digital information because it captures everything. So they would have all the evidence, and therefore there is no need whatsoever for an investigation because they would already have the evidence. Well, quite clearly, after more than a year, there's no evidence, and that's why they have an investigation. And if the media in the United States and England were not so totally corrupt, they would have pointed this out a long time ago. What's this investigation about? If all this Russiagate stuff happened, the NSA has it. Why don't they just turn it over? There's no national security stuff involved that they can't give the information. So, as Benny has said, then this thing is a hoax, and they keep it alive because they're one of two things. They either want to drive Trump out of office, or they want to make him unable to normalize relations with Russia. That's all this is about. There's no such thing as Russiagate. Flynn didn't do anything. There are none of these Russian connections. It's made up. And Benny is completely correct. I mean, he designed this system. He knows what it does. He put it there. And so he's right. If there was anything like this happened, they already have the evidence. But where is it?
Where is it, yeah. And nobody has mentioned it. You just mentioned, of course, the conduct of national media in the States and here. You know, apart from maybe one or two anchors on Fox News, nobody's asking the questions of those accusing Trump. Well, where is your evidence? You know, put up or shut up. How important in all of this? Because you and I spoke last year before the election and after the election. I have no doubt in my mind that whatever Trump is and whoever is controlling him now, I think because of a number of interviews that he gave over the years, that he was pretty sincere about, you know, withdrawing the interventionist United States or pulling back from interventionism. I think he meant that as a person. Personally, he meant that. Getting on with Russia, I think he personally meant that. I don't think the establishment cared too much because they knew once he was in power, they could manipulate him and mould him and do whatever they wanted, as we're seeing now. But obviously Syria and Iran are very important in this because Russia, of course, has been, has thwarted the plans for Syria through its standing alongside Bashar al-Assad. And of course, Russia would be a big stumbling block towards any future invasion of Iran. For us, it comes down to Syria and Iran. This is why we see the demonization of Russia and linking Russia to fraud in electoral situations like here, like in Germany, like in France, like in the United States. It comes down to Syria and Iran, Paul. What do you think?
No, I think it comes down to the budget and power of the United States military security complex. They need an enemy. And Russia's the enemy that the Obama regime constructed or reconstructed for them. They're not going to let go of it because if they don't have a credible enemy, they can't justify a budget of $1,000 billion a year.
Yeah.
So that's what it's about. Now, Iran and Syria, that's more about, well, of course, the military security complex are glad to have these bogeymen too, and North Korea, the more enemies, the better for your budget. But the one they really want is Russia, because it fits everybody's consciousness from the Cold War. It's an easy one to run with. It's a big country. Putin is clever. The Russians have a devastating military capability, and so that's a believable enemy. The Taliban are not, Al-Qaeda is not, you know, Syria and Iran are not. So whereas they probably are glad that we've got a whole bunch of enemies, then the one they want's Russia. So what is Syria and Iran about? That's about the Zionists. That's Israel. Israel is using, trying to use, the American military to overthrow Syria and Iran. Why? Because Israel wants southern Lebanon. It wants the water resources in southern Lebanon. It twice sent the Israeli army in to occupy southern Lebanon. And who drove them out both times? Hezbollah, the militia. Who supports Hezbollah? Syria and Iran. That's where Hezbollah gets the money, the arms. Without Syria and Iran support, Hezbollah is dead in the water. So Israel is using the idiot Americans to get rid of Syria and Iran so Israel can grab southern Lebanon. That's what that is about. It's not really about anything else.
The Greater Israel Project. I had Senator Richard Black on this program from Virginia, the Virginia State Senator. I know you'll know who he is, Paul, and I've had other politicians on the program. I share their view that while you're right, of course, the military-industrial complex budget, and you know that's a machine that needs to be fed with billions and billions of dollars. And that's of course very important. But I also believe, not because I'm a doomsayer or because I'm pessimistic, but I believe that this agenda is meant to ultimately end up in full-scale war, Paul, a massive destructive war. And there are forces, operating in the deep state who are not really concerned about billions of dollars for the complex, as you said, which is, of course, important. But it's for a full-scale war between the NATO countries and China, Russia, and, of course, North Korea. Do you go along with that? Richard Black has said that on this program. He believes it's what they want, a massive war. What do you think?
Well, I don't know. I don't think that because they wouldn't survive either. There wouldn't be, if there's a nuclear war between the United States and Russia, or especially Russia and China, there's not going to be anybody left alive on Earth. There'll be no one. So there's nothing anybody can gain from that. Now, it is entirely possible that there are demonic, satanic, crazed people planning something like that, but they haven't any expectation of surviving it.
Yeah.
So I don't think that. I think it's more like, I think we are headed to a nuclear war, but it's more likely to happen from mistakes. We've talked about this before, Richie.
Yeah, we have.
During the Cold War, you always had both sides working to diffuse the tensions. There were all sorts of arms agreements and other things. But what's happened since the Soviet Union collapsed is that the United States has violated every agreement, violated every one of the agreements put in place that gave trust between the powers. And now the United States is going even more absurd, making false accusations. The Russians know they're false. The Russians know that every time we demonize somebody, we invade them. That's what happened to Saddam Hussein. That's what happened to Gaddafi. That's what happened to Assad. That's what they tried to do in Iran. And the Russians see that we are making all kinds of military bases on their border.
Surrounding them, yeah.
On their seacoast, putting missiles on their borders, doing everything that's an indication that they're going to be attacked. So what this means is the next time somebody's early warning system gives a mistaken report that there are incoming ICBMs, somebody's going to believe it. They never believed it before. We've had hundreds of those false reports during the Cold War, and no one believed them because they said, doesn't make sense. We're working on this together. We're in agreement. But now, when you have these dangerously high tensions, some false alarm, there's a high chance it's going to be believed.
And then somebody counterfires something, and before you know it, you've got a problem.
And somebody pushes a button. That's right.
Let me ask you
and
this.
The other problem is that the Russians' response publicly is always low-key, even though internally they're getting more and more agitated about it. So Washington is looking at the low-key public response and thinks, okay, we can add more pressure, we can add more pressure, we can add more. And they may add so much pressure that the agitation inside Russia pushes the button. There's no reason for them to sit there and wait on an attack if they think that's what the United States is up to.
Yeah.
So I have said over and over how dangerous this is. So did last week Perry, who was the Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration. He said it's far more dangerous now than during the Cold War. And the public needs to understand this so that something can be done about it. Other people have pointed out how much more dangerous it is now. Stephen Cohen, who is the last remaining real Russian expert we have here, he has said this, that this is extremely dangerous. We never had this level of danger during the Cold War. And there's no public discussion. It's never mentioned. Nothing is ever said. You know, since we talked, I think it came out that the United States is collecting Russian DNA for the Air Force bioweapons lab. So the Russians say, well, so now they're trying to invent some kind of bioweapon that only kills Russians.
Yeah.
Well, you can't keep telling a superpower that you're trying to set them up like this and have them sit there and wait on it. This is madness. You know, and I think we have mentioned on the previous program that the Operation Command of the Russian High Command announced publicly at a Moscow security conference that they had come to the conclusion that the United States is planning a surprise nuclear attack on Russia. Well, why wasn't Trump on the phone instantly to Putin saying, oh, no, we're not doing anything like this. What assurances can we give you?
Yeah.
He did nothing. There was no response. I don't even think it was even reported in the American press. So here you have the greatest danger, I mean, other than if you believe global warming and stuff like that, which could be true too, this is the greatest danger that you can imagine. Washington and the idiot NATO countries, I mean, these NATO countries are idiotic to be backing Washington in this kind of hostility toward Russia. It convinces the Russians, well, they're out to get us.
I want to take you back to something. You and I have been speaking now long enough. By the way, Paul Craig Roberts is live, folks, former editor of the Wall Street Journal and former U.S. Assistant Treasury Secretary. Great to have Paul on. As always, paulcraigroberts.org. There's a wonderful article today called Can the American Left Be Resurrected? It's about how the left has been splintered and destroyed by identity politics and more. It's a really good article. Check it out, paulcraigroberts.org. I've known you a while now, and you're a man who chooses his words carefully. And a few minutes ago, you said, when I said that Richard Black and others think that there is an agenda to start a war, whether it's nuclear or not, but a protracted conflict between the superpowers. You mentioned the terms demonic and satanic. Now, I came up in commercial and national media. And, you know, I did my degrees like everybody else. I'm a system man. Well, I came from the system. These are possibilities that I think are very real and very appropriate. Why did you use those terms? Because it sounds to me like you've contemplated before whether there is some demonic or satanic element to it. You wouldn't have mentioned it otherwise. Go ahead.
Well, I was just emphasizing that if somebody's planning a war with Russia, then what you have operating is total evil without any kind of rationality or thought, because no one will survive this war. There's not going to be a bunker somewhere where the people doing this are going to survive. The planet won't survive. Nothing will survive. So these weapons today are immensely powerful. Immensely powerful. You know, the Russians have this new ICBM. They call it Satan II. One of them destroys the entirety of Great Britain. One of them.
Just one, yeah.
So what kind of survival? I mean, you know, how many of those things have to go off and there's nothing left? And then you get nuclear winter. These scientists talk about all the dust that goes up, the sun's blocked, nothing can grow. There's no food. So, you know, this is in addition to blast effects, radiation effects. They don't even know if the atmosphere will survive. That many weapons going up, burning everything up. The weapons now are immensely powerful. They're not the atomic bombs that wiped out the two Japanese cities. They can now wipe out entire countries.
Yeah, and we always.
That's all I meant by it. I just meant that this would have to be evil unleashed. It'd have to be Satan himself. I mean, he probably would be immune to it, as he's some kind of a god or something, you know. But that's what I meant. It's a form of.
Do you know what, Paul?
Insanity.
Of course, it would be. Do you know what? The reason I brought us back there is because I saw a tweet today that was deleted, but it was from a lawyer who's representing somebody who is speaking to the child abuse inquiry in the UK, the historic child abuse inquiry, because we know in this country and in the United States, very powerful people have been parts or members of paedophile rings for many, many years. It's coming to the surface now. We know this. Edward Heath being a very famous example of it here in the United Kingdom. But what's interesting, Paul, is psychotherapists and counsellors and psychologists, their patients are telling them, the survivors of abuse are telling them that Satanism has been and continues to be a huge part of a lot of this ritual child abuse that we see. So my ears just perked up when you talked about satanic and demonic. I wasn't trying to put words in your mouth, but, you know, I make the connection.
I'm talking about a different kind of
demonic.
I mean, if these satanic child abusers, they want to keep on abusing children. They don't want to be blown off the face of the earth.
You just don't know, though.
So I don't think that form of satanic behavior is what I had in mind. I was thinking about, Satan himself.
Before we run out of time, Paul, thanks for coming on, by the way. What do you hope? I mean, you're somewhere between pessimism and optimism, I think, in your writing. It's kind of healthy. What do you hope for 2018? What would you like to see happen next year? What is possible if people get up off their backsides and disengage from the identity politics and the foolishness of left-right and right-left? What could be achieved in 2018, do you think?
Well, I think what Vladimir Putin is hoping is that Europe will wise up and stop providing cover for Washington's aggression and for Washington's hostile actions toward Russia. I think Putin is hoping that at some point, even though every one of the European leaders are bought and paid for by Washington in answer to Washington, and their whole career depends on Washington, I think Putin knows all of that, but he's still hoping that at some point they're going to realize that Washington is driving the world to war with Russia. It will be nuclear. Europe will instantly disappear. Instantly. All this crap about NATO. NATO can't do anything. The Russians can take out NATO in a few seconds, and all of Europe with it. And I think Putin is hoping at some point the dumb shits in Europe will say, hey, what have we got to gain from America's hostility and America's world empire and America's effort to be the world hegemon and to be able to act unilaterally? And, hey, we're not doing this anymore. And somebody starts pulling out of NATO. That would stop this drive toward war. And the drive doesn't have to be intentional. It just happens from mistakes. So that's one thing. I keep waiting, like Putin, on Europe to wake up. And for the people to wake up. I mean, the European people should understand. They may be gone. And they need to be in the streets. They need to be holding the governments accountable. Why are you enabling Washington to push us into conflict with Russia? Why are you doing this? And if they have to, they've got to be violent against the governments. If they have to, they got to violently overthrow the governments that are cooperating with Washington and on the path to conflict with Russia. The same thing here. The people have got to understand that the people in Washington don't have any sense and have the entirety of their life and welfare at risk. They've got to say, hey, we're not standing for it. We don't care how militarized you have the police. We don't care what you think you're going to do with the military against us. We're not putting up with it. You're out. If we have to, we'll march on you and hang you off the lampposts. That's the kind of thing that's going to have to happen. It's not going to happen through democracy or elections. The elections don't mean anything when the ruling power elite is still there. Look, what was the difference between Obama and George W. Bush? Nothing. And now Trump, what can he do? Nothing. He's helpless. He can Twitter. He has to Twitter. That's all he can do. So it's not... There's not any democracy anywhere in the West. Everything is rigged. They're power groups, small numbers. There's an oligarchy. They rule. And they're taking great risk with the planet and every form of life on it. And so the media keeps all that from reaching the people.
That's right.
That's all the media is good for.
It's its job, yeah.
So somehow the people have got to catch on. I mean, your programs, my writing, there are other people besides us, as you know. And they've got to say, now, wait a minute. This is pointless. We don't care if... Why should we care that America can boss the world? It doesn't help us. How does it help us? It just puts us in conflict with countries who are not going to be bossed, which is Russia and China and Iran. They're not going to be bossed.
North Korea, of course.
And North Korea. They're not going to be bossed. And so you try to boss somebody who's not going to be bossed, you're going to go to conflict. And, you know, it has to be. There's enough intelligence left in European peoples, British peoples, Canadian peoples, Australian peoples, to see that and be aware of that. So that's really, you know, one can only hope that people wake up, or that even some of the politicians in Europe, in fact, we see that, don't we? Isn't this guy in Hungary raising hell about
that's about right,
it?
Over Soros' interference,
over
that's
there.
Right, yeah.
They're not very big or strong or powerful countries, but they're raising questions. If they pull out, you know.
Do you know, Paul?
You know, who knows? The British tried to pull out of Brexit. As I said, I doubt they ever will get out. The United States is not going to permit it. But, you know, if you've got 2 years to go through, the cost will be so high by the time you get to the end of it, you won't be able to afford to get out. So,
well, it's not only that. It gives them 2 years to come up with an excuse to reverse the decision or go to the people again. We're just about out of time. Folks, I want to mention again, go to paulcraigroberts.org online. Paul, as usual, thanks so much for your help during 2017. We want to wish you and your family a wonderful Christmas, a real happy Christmas there in Virginia. Look after yourself over the holidays, and thanks for everything this year, and we look forward to catching up with you in early 2018.
All right, Richie, I look forward to it too. All the best to you.
Thanks, Paul. The great Paul Craig Roberts live on the line to us there from Virginia, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of the Treasury and, of course, former editor of the Wall Street Journal, live on the line for Thursday, December 7th, 2017. It's exactly the top of the hour. So we're going to be speaking shortly in a few minutes' time with Kevin Myers. I'm really looking forward to that. Former Sunday Times journalist. Kevin is an author who has written several outstanding books. Very fortunate to read some of his books this year. I'll talk about those shortly. Kevin, of course, wrote an article around about the time there was the furore over the BBC gender pay issues and the pay gap when the salaries of the BBC's top earners were published. I think for the first time. I'm pretty sure it was the first time that had happened. And there were some obvious glaring discrepancies between some of the more experienced male and female presenters and producers. Kevin wrote an article about it anyway, and in the article he royally noticed, and noted even, that presenters Claudia Winkleman and Vanessa Feltz were doing quite well. And to paraphrase Kevin, I don't have the exact quote here, I could get it in a second, but to paraphrase him, he basically said that, you know, Jewish people were not known for their stupidity in negotiating their finances and minding their finances and negotiating their salaries. This was taken to be anti-Semitic and hateful. What was funny about that was, there wasn't anything funny about that and what happened to Kevin Myers. But what was funny from my point of view was a couple of days after the Sunday Times dropped Kevin, I was on a plane to Southampton and I sat next to a man whom I got speaking with, and he was a Jewish man from North Manchester, and he didn't know anything about me. And we had a chat, and we got on to talking about the news and politics and stuff. And I said, what do you think of this story about the journalist Kevin Myers? Now, Kevin was born in England, but was raised in Ireland. And he said, I don't see what the commotion is all about. He said, and I mentioned this at the time because I did a monologue on this. He said, Kevin Myers was right in what he said. He said it's probably not right to make a generalisation about anything. But he said, if there is one thing you can say about Jewish families, is we do emphasise the value of money and the value of things with our children. You know, we teach them the importance of money, of saving money, of looking after money, of getting good value for money. I made the point at the time that I had a lot of experience when I was first in Manchester many years ago, of moving around a Pakistani community. And I got to know some Pakistanis quite well. One of them is still a very good friend of mine. He's in Rochdale. And he said at the time, and he said to me recently, that Jewish trait, if you want to call it that, of not being miserly or stingy at all or anything like that, but understanding the value of money and valuing yourself in financial transactions. My mate Imran said that's also a notable trait of the Pakistani community. So we spend a lot of time talking about the value of money when we were young. And anyway, this Jewish guy said to me on the plane, he said, I don't know what the commotion is all about. I don't see anything offensive in what Myers said, but he was fired. And he was horrified, quite understandably, by it. And he's going to join us in a minute to talk about that, but also to talk about free speech in general, the state of the media in the UK and in Ireland. A little bit of identity politics, but we'll also talk about causing offence, the right to cause offence as much as the right to be offended in the 21st century. So we'll take a very quick break. When we return, Kevin Myers on The Richie Allen Show.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
Book launches are often hyped. Then you open the first page and... But David Icke's new book, Everything You Need to Know But Have Never Been Told, really will astonish you. Thought-provoking and controversial, it's available now. So read a real page-turner. Everything You Need to Know But Have Never Been Told by former footballer and presenter David Icke. Available exclusively at davidicke.com.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Is your mind full of ideas, yet you struggle to put them down on paper?
Characters with no home, unfinished concepts that you always wanted to finalize,
yet lacked knowledge and drive to complete? The Creative Writing Course from Creative Imaginings
may be the long-awaited answer, designed to help you finish your masterpiece
with better language techniques, detailed study of the character, plotted suspense chain, and
valuable information to get published.
Don't delay your creation. Complete your 100% online course at www.creativeimaginings.com.au.
Right, welcome back to the programme. Always good to be with you. It is Thursday, the 7th of December 2017. My name is Richie Allen. Keep the tweets coming in. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. If you'd like to see what other people are tweeting, it's very simple on Twitter. All you need to do is put Richie Allen Show, all one word, in Twitter. When you press enter, you'll see all the tweets that get sent to me. We get dozens, sometimes hundreds of tweets into the programme while it's on. 7 minutes past the hour for Thursday's programme. Our next guest, then, is somebody I've a lot of admiration for. Any Irishman growing up in Ireland would have read his columns, his Irishman's Diary in the Irish Times. He's a great writer. I mentioned earlier on, born in England, but grew up in the Republic of Ireland, was in Leicester during his teen years as well, the subject of a great book. He was in national and international news, of course, some weeks ago because of the opinion piece he wrote in the Sunday Times about the BBC gender pay gap. And I mentioned just before the break that in the piece, he wryly and shrewdly made a comment about Claudia Winkleman and Vanessa Feltz, who, despite there being great disparity between BBC female producers and presenters and their male counterparts, Vanessa Feltz and Claudia Winkleman had done quite well. Kevin said, again paraphrasing, but he said, you know, Jewish folks not known for their stupidity when doing financial deals for themselves and negotiating their salaries and stuff. Nothing wrong in that. I mentioned that on a plane to Southampton, only a couple of days later, sitting next to a Jewish man, he couldn't see what all the controversy was about. But he was fired from the Sunday Times and he was hung out to dry. And incredibly, and as an Irish journalist, I was, maybe I shouldn't have been surprised, quite staggered that no features writer, no opinion writer in Irish news came out in support of him. It's quite staggering, really. I'm delighted to say that he's on the line to us now. Let's welcome to the programme Kevin Myers. Kevin, welcome to the programme. How are you?
I'm very well, and it's a pleasure talking to you, Richie.
It's a real pleasure. I'm just going to get this out of the way. This is going to sound like brown nosing, but it isn't. Your book concerning your time in Northern Ireland, Watching the Door, a memoir, is a magnificent read, Kevin. I've read it. I read it this year, and I'll be reading it again, and I've passed it on to somebody to read. It's a great book, a great account of Northern Ireland in the 1970s. Great stuff. How are you feeling, Kevin, after everything that's gone on over the last few weeks? Are you still kind of in shock, or how are you dealing with it?
No, I'm dealing with it quite well, actually. I've realised now that I was swimming in a sewer, that journalism has been corrupted largely by the new media, by the phenomenon of tweet that you're just talking about. And it's not compatible. Serious, reflective, developed journalism is not compatible with the world of social media, where a half-baked idea can be released in half a second and that can achieve prominence. Richie, just to put things in perspective, the column I wrote that brought about my downfall and the end of my career was a poor column. It was poorly phrased and it was insensitive. And I have to take into account and take responsibility for my failing to recognize that the Jewish people, having had a particularly unspeakable history, and we are within the living memory of the Holocaust, are sensitive to allegations of fiscal corruption. I was attributing no such motive to those two ladies. I genuinely credited them with being able to, or getting agents, which is the most important thing, agents able to negotiate good salaries for them. And I said in the piece, good for them. However, it was misinterpreted. However, that misinterpretation was not accidental. I didn't know until I paid an expert to look at this thing that at around 12:15 on the Sunday morning, that's to say 12 a.m., that my column appeared online, and I didn't even know it appeared online, somebody began to analyze my columns using perhaps LexisNexis search machines, so that by 2:00 in the morning, while the rest of us slept, my career and my reputation were over. They had assembled, by an incredible process of computer analysis, lines from different columns back to the 1980s. And they had assembled this picture of a completely fictional Kevin Myers. And by around 3:00 in the morning, the column was taken down because it was alleged it was a vile anti-Semitic rant, was the term that was used.
Kevin, who is they? Who is they? Who was behind that trawling through?
I don't know. I know that one of the first people to comment on it was Lionel Barber of the Financial Times, but I'm not saying he was responsible for it because I don't know who was responsible for assembling this composite picture. But the composite picture, using this tweet, vile anti-Semitic slur or vile anti-Semitic rant, it took two forms, destroyed my career, my reputation, my livelihood. While I slept, while you slept, while your listeners slept. So I got a phone call at 9:00 in the morning from my page editor, my Irish page editor, said, "This is, you're in real trouble." And I had no idea why. And the Martin Ivins, the editor of the Sunday Times in London, announced that I was not merely being fired, but I would never work for the Sunday Times again for the rest of my life. This is what you say of an unrepentant terrorist, or a child rapist, or a grievous criminal who is beyond redemption. It's not what you say to a columnist who made a mistake. That mistake passed through the editorial filters twice over in Dublin, and at least four times in London. All these people failed to see what was picked up at 12:15 in the morning, online, and then was broadcast for the next 48 hours around the world. That Sunday afternoon, I was number one story across Europe,
yeah,
Ireland, and the United States of America. In America, the profile of the story was gained impetus because J.K. Rowling, who has 15 million followers in America, repeated the libel that it was a toxic anti-Semitic rant, and her thing was picked up by Chelsea Clinton. This had an exponential effect on the impact of the story, and I have to say that the majority of young journalists today do not need to do the fundamental thing of checking facts before they repeat non-facts as news, in fact. And so I was turned into a Holocaust denier based on a column I wrote 10 years ago dealing with the Holocaust. Now, I have written 20 major pieces on the Holocaust in my career as a journalist, all of them attesting to the horrors of the Holocaust, yeah, to the Final Solution. But on this one column, disputing the usefulness of making Holocaust denial a criminal offence, I said it's very difficult to define that as a criminal offence because the Holocaust took so many forms. You can remove Auschwitz and the gas chambers, and you still have the Final Solution. 3.5 million Jews were butchered without being gassed. They were hacked to death. They were worked to death. They were burned to death in their synagogues. They were marched to death. 3.5 million without... So you can't make a legal definition.
No, you can't.
The sub-editor wrote, there was no Holocaust.
But
now,
you know
I
what,
was
Kevin?
Beside myself with rage when that headline appeared, but nothing came of it. But that morning, the fatal final Sunday morning of my career, somebody picked up that headline and tweeted it. There was no Holocaust with the byline Kevin Myers underneath it.
Which you never
said. There was a Holocaust. It was the most comprehensive, wicked undertaking in the history of the human species.
I remember the column.
But I just argued with the word.
I remember.
And that was the final nail in the coffin internationally. And if you ask anyone in America, any Jew in America, or even in London or Australia, the name Kevin Myers will be mentioned as the Holocaust-denying anti-Semite thug.
Not necessarily. Look, I remember the column from years ago. I remember it. I hadn't long left WLRFM at that stage. Look, Norman Finkelstein and Shlomo Zand and other Jewish men and scholars and women who've been on this programme would say that you did yourself no favours because the Holocaust industry is something which, you know, is alive and well. Nobody denies what the Nazis did to Jews in Nazi Germany.
Well, they do. You see, that's the problem. In the Labour Party, they do. In the British Labour Party, they do. They say they call them Zionists. They say, what's so awful about what happened to the Jews or the Zionists during the Third Reich? Or it was exaggerated. But listen, Richie, it's not my job to do myself favours.
No.
It's my job to tell a challenging truth which might cause me to be unpopular. But the last thing any worthwhile journalist should be doing is looking to do himself or his reputation favours, or her reputation favours. We get nowhere. But listen, just to put things in perspective, because I haven't said it, the Irish Jewish community stood almost as one behind me. They said, this man is not a Holocaust denier. He's a friend of Jews. He has given so much testimony to the fact that the Holocaust took place. What did the Israeli ambassador do? Well, he took me out for lunch.
Yes, that's right.
What did the Jewish community do when the centenary of the Balfour Declaration came up a month ago? Who did they ask to chair that day-long seminar? They asked me to spend chairing the day.
It's important to know that.
Well, I was with the Israeli ambassador and a group of other people giving a testimony to the 800,000 Jews who were expelled from Arab countries after the foundation of the State of Israel, a state which I have repeatedly defended over the last 20 years.
Do you know what we won't do, Kevin? Do you know what we won't do?
Ireland, because so many of the commentators in Ireland are anti-Israeli.
Well,
I'm pro-Israeli and proud to be pro-Israeli.
And I'll say this, can I jump in quickly? Let me jump in quickly. Because I'd love in the future you to come on and we'll talk about the State of Israel. And listen,
sure.
I absolutely respect your right to be pro-Israeli. I'm not pro-Israeli. I'm pro-Palestinian. I make no bones about it. I don't hide behind pretending to be, you know, objective. I'm not. And I respect your rights to be pro-Israeli. I want to go back, though. Because when I said that I've been an admirer of yours for years, I meant it. There's no but here. There's no but coming. I've been an admirer of yours, listening to you on Irish radio and on television, sometimes adopting unpopular positions or the non-populist position because you believed in it. I've seen you argue with Gay Byrne, with Pat Kenny. I always loved the fact that you were there, sometimes on your own, getting berated. I thought, I love Myers. He'll say what he means, and he means what he says. You could have been a Yorkshireman. Now, tell you what cheesed me off more than anything. Why did you apologise? Number one, let me finish. Number one,
I cheesed you off, but two things. One is
why did you apologise?
Stuff is intolerable.
But it wasn't anti-Semitic.
Since it is the worst crime in history, and since my name was being associated with somehow or other the justification of this, I had to clear the atmosphere. Two, I was exhausted. I hadn't slept for 2 days or nights. I was suddenly overwhelmed with this social media tidal wave tsunami of hatred, and I thought the best thing to do was to go on air and to apologise to Claudia Winkleman and Vanessa Feltz. Claudia hasn't said a word about this.
No.
Vanessa Feltz was upset, and I'm not saying she was wrong to be upset, but I did want to
she was wrong to be upset.
Upset that they have felt, because I wasn't making anti-Semitic observations. I respect and admire the Jewish people. I think they are the most talented people in the history of the world. That is my genuine feeling. I'm not saying that to, you know, curry favour with your audience. But there is no way of coping with the crisis that I faced last July, August, correctly. There isn't a right solution. I mean, friends rang up and say sorry. That didn't do me any good at all, because the Irish media, putting aside the anti-Semitic stuff, then turned me into a misogynist.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, at the same time. But I want to stick with this. Look, I accept why you apologise, but I want to talk while you're on tonight, and thanks for coming on and giving us your time. What about, Kevin, the job of talented feature writers for broadsheet newspapers? What about the right to cause offence? What about
you said earlier on
that, you know, the Jews have a terrible recent history and Nazi Germany and all of that, and the Jews are a bit sensitive. Now, Kevin, I don't have a bigoted bone in my body towards anybody, any group or anybody else, but I say to hell with people being sensitive about stuff. You know, why should we or anybody worry about what somebody might feel about something that we, you know, write or that we might say? Why do we have to be apologetic for that? You said it's over. Well, if it's over, democracy is over. If we don't have
your
the right to cause
is
offense.
In dire trouble. Democracy is in dire trouble because no newspaper can survive the sort of attacks that occurred on my life, my reputation. No one is going to step outside the line. And you have already referred to this, Richie, the fact that all of, and just about the entire body of Irish journalists lined themselves up against me because I was the white crow. I was outside the family. Now, outside the family in every sense, because I have never subscribed to the general consensuses of Irish life or consensus. I am anti-Republican. I am pro-Israel. And all the other things. I am a severe critic of feminism. That does not make me a misogynist. It means I'm a critic of feminism, not a hater of women. Misogyny means I hate women. And the first phone calls and the first emails I get were all from women, including one woman who I've only met twice in my life, who sent me €1,000 to pay for the legal cost of my suing the Sunday Times, which I'm not going to do because I haven't got the money. But the fact is, I'm not a misogynist. But nonetheless, the feminists in Ireland, Republicans in Ireland, and all the liberal left, the most powerful and toxic conspiracy of all, they made it their business to destroy my life, my career, my livelihood, and they succeeded. And when you've been hit by a terrible disease or hit by a bus, you have to acknowledge that you have been hit, and life will not be the same. It doesn't mean life is over. It's certainly not in my case. I'm not going to submit to complete annihilation at the hands of these very, very diseased and demented and immoral people. But the fact is that they have succeeded in this particular battle. But the war has to continue because, you know, there will be no democracy unless there is the toleration of dissent. Now, I am supposed to be giving a talk in the Little Museum in Dublin next spring. And already the Little Museum is coming under... That's a museum of the city of Dublin. It's a delightful museum. And it's coming under pressure not to allow me to speak ever.
By who, Kevin? By who?
But I don't know the names of the people, but I do know that they are under pressure.
You see, what we're seeing, Kevin, can I just come back in? What we're seeing here in the United Kingdom, this is devastating. We're seeing small groups, small collectives. Now, I've got to put a caveat on this. I make television programmes with a company in North Manchester that is run by Jewish businessmen who are very, very well known and very well established in Manchester city centre. Incredibly well known. I've got to emphasise that. These are well-known Jewish guys, and I've been working with them for a number of years. These guys had a discussion with me about your article. They found it funny. They laughed. They said, well, yeah, you know, we mind our financial affairs and we educate ourselves about the value of money more than the guy. And they were joking about it. But he said, there's nothing in it. There's nothing in it. I met Jews in London. There's nothing in it. I spoke to Jews on this program. There's nothing in it. We have pro-Zionist hate groups like the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism and the Northwest Friends of Israel, who, and one of the former, by the way, the CAA, has charity status in this country. And I sent you some documents today. I don't know whether you read them or not.
I did, yeah.
This is a tyranny that's tantamount to McCarthyism, where they are making stories up about people, including this presenter.
Yeah, I got them. They lacerated me.
Who are these people, Kevin? How are these people getting away with that?
I have no idea. But it is a feature of modern life. I don't read tweets. I have as little to do with the internet as possible. I'm that kind of man, and I'm that kind of age. And I haven't got an iPhone. I've got an old-fashioned mobile phone that I got 25 years ago. So I could do nothing but just get a telephone call on. I can't exchange information. I don't know anything about how this world works. It's loathsome. And it's not compatible with democracy. It just can't, because no one can withstand the sort of wave of hatred and misrepresentation that I got. Because everyone, you know, in any normal conversation, any article writing, you will write a sentence which out of context will sound terrible.
You know,
that's
Kevin.
That's what these people do. And they're sick.
You know,
they're sick. You know, they're the sort of people who would be marginalised in an earlier society.
This particular group, the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, they were formed in 2015 during Operation Protective Edge. Now, I respect your support for Israel, even though I disagree with it. But we're grown-ups, Kevin. I love your writing. I can be your friend, whether we agree or disagree on one geopolitical issue or not. Operation Protective Edge was happening. I see it as the wanton slaughter of thousands of Palestinians. These guys were formed to become a kind of a Hasbara-based kind of attack group on anybody who asks any questions about the behaviour of Israel. And they say that people like the jazz musician Gilad Atzmon, people like David Icke, people like Alison Shablo, they say they are hateful, anti-Semitic Holocaust deniers, when in fact they are not. If they were, they'd be challenged on programmes like this, to, you know, challenged as to why do you think that? Why do you say that? And yet they're getting away with it. For me, it's all about...
They're doing the same to me, and
they're doing the same
Israel
to you.
I mean,
yeah.
I wouldn't give, you know, unconditional approval to everything that the Israelis have done in Gaza, but at a certain point, all states will act against their enemies that are firing rockets into their cities. That's what all states will do, and the Israelis did. And they sent in... They texted people warnings to get down because there were missiles coming in. They phoned people. Now, you and I are not going to discuss the Gaza thing.
But no, not tonight.
They say if they took me down, I who would give conditional justification for that invasion, I who stand by the Jews, I who have been repeated defender of Israel, if they can take me down, what are they going to do down to people who are real enemies of Israel?
Well, not enemies, not enemies.
Or critics, people like
not
you.
Not enemies, critics, exactly, not enemies. And by the way, just to throw it in there, Wile E. Coyote has got better rockets than the Palestinians. But again, we're not going to go down that road because we can go down that in the future. Kevin, you described a liberal progressive agenda. We see it. And it is out to destroy anybody who questions anything. If you ask questions about same-sex couples adopting children, you're a bigot, you're hateful, you've got to be taken down. If you ask questions about... If you ask questions about the fact that they're asking children to consider their gender in primary schools in the UK and to consider gender fluidity, oh, you hate gays and lesbians, you have to be stopped. We see it with the likes of Owen Jones constantly working across British media. This we see it in universities, people being deplatformed. We see safe spaces. I think when I first invited you on the programme, I said to you, I'd love to get your opinion on safe spaces at university. Jesus Christ, Kevin, you're a... university graduate. Can you imagine when you went to university? Oh, listen, you don't have to attend this lecture now because something might be said that might offend you. Kevin,
yeah,
what's going on?
Students are now excused listening to law on rape because it might distress them. Now, what's happened is that my generation, the generation slightly younger than me, have produced the most infantilized generation of undergraduates in the history of the world. It's no such lily-livered, spineless species has ever been created, but they are the creation of the post-60s generation. And this was a generation that said was multicultural, all values are equally important, it really doesn't matter who you are or what you are, all civilizations are the same, which means basically that Renaissance, Florence is the same as Haiti today. Now, if you actually want to argue that making supposition that Renaissance and Florence wasn't the same as Haiti, you're probably going to be called the other way around.
Yeah.
You'll be called a racist for making a comparison. But the fact is that some civilizations do function at a higher level than other civilizations, and that's why some civilizations produce motor cars and great playwrights, and other civilizations produce nothing other than icebergs. Now, but that's not allowed to be said anymore. And all you can say is these days is all civilizations are equal, all values are the same. Islam is as tolerant and as kind and as generous as Christianity, and so on and so forth. Now, we all of us in our bottom hearts know that this isn't the case, that we know that some civilizations are richer, more productive, produce finer people, wiser people, cleverer people, kinder people. And other civilizations don't do these things. But that is not a matter of the public discourse anymore. You have to pretend that everyone is the same. And the result is these children arrive in universities and discover that actually the world isn't as it was painted to them by their parents. It's full of complexity and it's full of difference. And boo-hoo, they don't like it. So even in Trinity College Dublin, there are safe spaces now. And the safe space is going to be a fairly universal phenomenon. I must tell you, mentioning Trinity College, not one single Irish academic came out in support of my freedom of speech. Not one.
Terrified of the Zionist lobby, Kevin. This is the thing, you see.
No, it's not the Zionist lobby. They're not in Ireland. There isn't a Zionist lobby in Ireland. There's a pro-Palestinian lobby in Ireland, which is very, very powerful.
No, I didn't mean in Ireland necessarily.
The only person in public life who's not Jewish who stands up for Israel. So there is no Zionist lobby in Ireland. There's a very strong pro-Palestinian lobby. But it's not a question of this lobby or that lobby. Is freedom of speech worth defending? Well, it's not in Ireland anymore, and I suspect not in Britain, because I said not one columnist came out forthright in support of me. Only one politician did. That was Senator David Norris, with whom I have crossed swords on many occasions. He's vehemently pro-Palestinian, vehemently pro-anti-Israeli, and he acknowledges my right to be pro-Israeli, and I acknowledge his right to be pro-Palestinian, and yours too.
Yeah.
And that's not the point, you see. It used to be the point where we acknowledge one another's right to talk, because that's the basis of all civilization. Now, you have to defend the right of somebody you disapprove of to speak.
Kevin,
some sort of exception.
I mean,
there is a dead end. No civilization can result from this. No form of enlightenment. No great age of enlightenment. No philosophy is possible. All you have is silence, cowed silence, dominated by the sort of journalists who in previous generations would be regarded as sort of braying sanctimonious buffoons, like Fintan O'Toole in the Irish Times, who's now taken very seriously. He launched 3 attacks on me in 6 or 7 days.
That's right. Yeah, I read the articles. Yeah. Yeah, I read the article.
This is unspeakable.
Kevin, I just want to...
He didn't say anything about freedom of speech. Why just leave me alone? My career was already dead by the time he came wading in. But it's not good enough.
Well, you don't have freedom of speech, so you don't.
To be kicked to death.
You don't have...
Well, not by him.
Not by him, no. But you don't have freedom of speech, Kevin.
The mass of the assembled media. That's what they chose to do. They kept on kicking long after I admitted I wasn't going to be writing again. Because it gives them some sort of visceral satisfaction. It also gives them some moral pleasure, too, because they feel they're doing a noble and moral deed by silencing somebody who is clearly a bad man because he disagrees with them.
I just want to make a couple of quick points, Kevin. Just a couple of quick points. I wasn't suggesting the Zionist lobby in Ireland. There is a group in Ireland called Irish for Israel. There are other groups as well, but not in Ireland, but globally, number one. But number two, I was taught coming up that there's one thing to talk about Voltaire all the time. It's easy to throw out the Voltaire line. But I was taught, you know, those who are really defending freedom of speech will defend the rights of those they disagree with more vociferously than anything. You know, and I've always said that. You know, there are people who come on this programme. They come from certain backgrounds, the United States, elsewhere, and they might be, you know, on the far right. And we will take them on and we will argue with them and we will put counterpoints to their positions. That's the way it used to be. It's the way I was brought up in radio in Ireland, that, you know, there was no such thing as an opinion that was so abhorrent that people couldn't hear it, that it couldn't be heard by them. And I'm sad to say that in this country, we are seeing a couple of very, very, very small groups that have been able to get people's events cancelled, have been able to get people thrown out of buildings where they had arranged concerts and talks based on a pack of lies, and nobody is standing up to it. And
No, it's shocking. And nobody. The only thing they need to do is to say there will be a security problem at such and such a venue. Does your insurance cover that?
Or you lose money. You know.
So that's it. It is shocking. It is absolutely shocking, and what is the most shocking aspect of this is the compliance and the cowardice and the consensual submission of both the media and the political classes. It does take some leadership. Now, in Ireland, 2 days after I was traduced by the editor of the Irish, by the Sunday Times, Martin Ivins, who said I would never work again, the Taoiseach of Ireland, our Prime Minister, Leo Varadkar, was asked on the street when he was going to attending another function, what did he think of my column? It's outrageous, anti-Semitic, misogynistic, and what about? And he said that the Sunday Times had taken the right action. And the Thornister, the Deputy Prime Minister, at another occasion, a woman, said the same thing. Now, this, I am an Irish national. This is the first time that I know of that an Irish national has been betrayed by his Prime Minister in the interests of political correctness and the interests of a multinational like News International and Rupert Murdoch. And the most extraordinary thing was that the assembled left of Ireland approved of the deeds of Rupert Murdoch and News International. This is a group and a man they normally revile.
But when
it comes to enforcing political correctness and silencing Kevin Myers once and for all, here we got the Hitler-Ribbentrop pact, the Stalin-Hitler pact, all over again, left and right, unite to destroy me.
We call now it virtue signalling, Kevin.
This is totalitarianism in the making.
Well, we call it
left and right. I don't believe such a thing as left and right. There's authoritarianism and there's libertarianism. And you are libertarians and I'm a libertarian. We disagree with one another. We allow one another to disagree and to be heard.
And to be heard.
But the authoritarian, the new authoritarians of the social media, they tolerate nothing. They only want agreement.
Can I bring something up?
That is in order to destroy. They're like Daleks.
They are like Daleks. Let me bring up two things on that. One was we call this virtue signalling. How these people on the left and the right, how they couldn't wait to get to a camera last week to express their disgust at some retweets by the US President Donald Trump. They couldn't wait to get on there. We call this virtue signalling. But Kevin, we had a situation in Ireland which mirrored yours. It wasn't as severe as what happened to you. But the Irish broadcaster George Hook, who's a bit like Marmite, you either love George or you don't love him. I happen to think George is all right, I don't mind him. George Hook did something, Kevin, that I did on radio many years ago, but I got away with it because I was a nobody. I was a nobody, so I got away with it. I said something on radio many years ago about women getting pissed when they were out drinking. I said, look, I'm a man. I'm a big 6'6", ignorant, baldy bastard from Waterford. I can go out and get legless, and I can probably find my way into a taxi and get home. Women are vulnerable when they get drunk. Now, what George Hook actually said was that girl did not deserve to be raped. She did not ask for it. He reiterated this. He said it several times. She didn't ask for it. But can we have a conversation about personal responsibility when you're out? George Hook was destroyed for a short time. He was a misogynist. He was victim blaming, and he was piled in on by the Irish liberal, so-called liberal press, in the same way that you were, Kevin. Another brilliant example of this madness. Jesus Christ! All the guy did was express an opinion. Let him express his opinion.
I had not been reading newspapers for the last 3 months. It's very probable that I'll never read a newspaper again. But I made an exception. I was able to get online his the words he's used. I mean, they're perhaps a little bit unbalanced, but he wasn't reading a script. He was speaking impromptu.
Yeah.
And most of what he was saying I would agree with. And he said that the rapist deserved to go down for the rest of his life. Well, I would say this and be given a good flogging every morning, and maybe one in the evening too. Do not treat a woman like that, no matter what. No matter
Absolutely.
What you've had to drink, you may not violate her. But he did make the point that everyone, this is you and me and everyone, has to take account of the circumstances in which they may find themselves. And I will not march down the Shankill Road waving an tricolour singing God Bless the Pope.
No.
Now, I have the right to do that, but I'm not going to. So, nor should a woman find herself in the circumstances where her safety is in danger, and this is true for us all. George knew he'd made a mistake in his wording. He apologized. It made no difference. No difference. And the same interest groups that destroyed me destroyed him, including, and I didn't mention this, the Quangos. The Quangos, these semi-autonomous government-funded bodies, which are paid for by the taxpayer, like the National Women's Council, Irish Migrant Council, and so on and so forth. These have a single set of opinions. Unless you agree with them, you are therefore a rapist or a racist or whatever. All the terms that were essentially thrown at me, not rapist, but certainly I was called a racist. And there isn't any antibody against these government-sponsored bodies.
No.
So having apologized, George found that he was no better off than he had been before he apologized. And the same hunting pack that went after me and destroyed me, they destroyed me, as a journalist, a columnist working in mainstream newspapers, they destroyed him. And Fintan O'Toole, whose name I mentioned earlier on, said that he would never work for News Talk, never be interviewed for News Talk, because they hadn't sacked
George Hook.
And so on and so forth. These people, they are self-congratulatory, they're unself-critical, they live in a cocoon of self-congratulation. They don't know the rest of the world. They wouldn't know what happened to me when I went to Tala, which you'd know about, but most of us, there's a working class estate outside Dublin.
That's right.
Popped in to buy a burger, and two local working class men. I don't say that in a condescending sense. It's just that they were working class men with working class accents. One was with his wife and his two children. Oh, their two children. And the first man by himself came by and shook his hand. He said, "Sometimes you infuriate me, sometimes you make me laugh, sometimes you educate me, but you've always been worthwhile reading, and I just hope you haven't gone." And I said, "I'm sorry, I'm gone. I am gone. It's over." And he said, that's tragic. And as I walked out, this man accosted me and he said, "Look, I want to talk to you. I think what's happened to you is shocking." And he said, "But if you think I'm mad about what's going on, you should speak to my wife." And I said, "Where's your wife?" He said, just there. So he introduced me to his wife, and we kissed. She said, "What's happened to you is a shame. It's a disgrace, because journalism is all about hearing things you don't want to hear. And then maybe, having heard those things you haven't heard before and don't want to hear, maybe you change your mind." And she said, "What's happened to you is just about the death of journalism in Ireland." Well, I thought at that point she was exaggerating, but I don't think she was exaggerating anymore. It's just a monochrome now. And who buys a monochrome? Who's going to buy a newspaper that consists of the same opinions which they perhaps already have, which they've heard 1,000 times, which are not going to change, because everyone is too scared of the Quango police who ride a shotgun on the herd of cattle. And what cattle, what head of cattle is going to depart from the herd? Well, no one is. They're going to stay in the centre, and who's going to buy a newspaper that consists solely of this grey, moralising cant, which contains nothing new. It contains no new perspectives, no new information, no thoughts that might challenge the consensus. They want to lie and die in this consensus. And within that death comes the death of our civilization as we have known it, back to the Enlightenment, back to the emergence of newspapers in the 18th century, back to the Industrial Revolution, the proliferation of popular newspapers for working-class people and middle-class people, and newspapers that knew their audience and would try to educate their audience in ways the audiences weren't expecting, and that way audiences became enlightened and changed government and changed the nature of society and allowed divorce laws and allowed Mary Stopes lessons to be taught in schools so that people understood the nature of childbirth and contraception and so on and so forth.
But
to the great calamity of the 1960s when my generation began to be parents and we taught our children it's all the same no matter who you are or what you are, all values are of equal value. And we all know who are listening to this, all of us know that not all values are equal. Some values are superior to others, and the most important value that has made Western civilization the greatest civilization in the history of the world is the freedom of thought, and then that greater freedom to express that thought.
And what we have today, and I've never written, full stop, I'm not a very good writer, but I've been a producer and a broadcaster successfully for many years. I'm out on my own now because I can't talk about these things on commercial radio or television. It's just not allowed. And I mean that. I'm not, paying lip service to that. I can't speak to the men and women that I do speak to on this show. I wouldn't be allowed to speak to them on other networks. So what we're left with is we're left with a media which basically parrots the establishment agenda and the establishment narrative. That's what we have, Kevin, like it or lump it.
Well, you don't actually have to like it or lump it because it's not going to survive much longer. That's quite obvious. It's not; these things are not compatible with one another. They're fire and water. Now, we've already seen what's happened in Britain, the disconnect between the elites, the media and the political elites, and the ordinary particularly in England, the ordinary voter. They voted Brexit. And we've seen the same thing in America where the elites said, well, Hillary Clinton is certainly going to win this. There's no chance of Trump winning, and Trump won. And every time that they have a referendum in Europe on any issue to do with the advancement of the European single European state, they get defeated. So what they do is they choose a form of a ratification, which is always dependent on non-referendal approval. That's to say, they seek the consent of the elites, not of the ordinary people. And in Ireland, consistently people have voted no to the referendums when they are first presented to
them. That's right.
So we had this profound division within Western Caucasian life. I'm using that to include Canada and the United States of America and Europe, where the values that once were cherished were told, such as national identity. We're now told that national identity isn't important. We're told this by Fine Gael and Fine Gael, the two nationalist parties of Ireland.
They're told
the national identity, which people gave their lives for in 1916 and 1919 to 21, 22, 23. That was no longer important. The people who fought in the Battle of Britain and who landed in Arnhem and Normandy and fought all the way through to liberate Bergen-Belsen, they're told that actually national identity doesn't count anymore because we're all Europeans. No, I'm not a European. I'm an Irishman before anything else. I'm happy to belong to a European culture. But my identity, my state, my people, my culture, my government and my leader, they're all Irish. And I don't want them to change. I don't want to be governed by a Belgian. I don't want to be governed by a Pole. I want Poles to be governed by Poles. And I want Poles to be free in certain numbers, restricted numbers, to come to Ireland. And I profoundly disagree with the notion of free movement of peoples from Romania and Bulgaria and Poland into Ireland, regardless of numbers, regardless of, or Britain, that is also the case, regardless of our ability to cope with them. I mean, this is absurd that if you make your home really attractive, it will invite so many incomers that it will no longer be attractive, and least of all attractive to the people who made it attractive in the first place. You wouldn't treat your own home like that, so why would you treat your homeland like that? And it's a pretty good rule of housekeeping. If you would behave in a certain fashion for your home, is that not the way your country should also be run? Would you leave your back door open at night in where you live? Then why would you leave your back door home of your open in your homeland? The very simple questions which should be asked are not being asked, and people who attempt to ask them are normally called racist.
You're called racist, yeah. I mean, we talk a lot about this the, you know, the social engineering in Europe, who's behind it and what and why and all these issues. We're nearly coming to the end. I just want to say something to you. You said your career is finished. I did mention to you on the phone a few weeks ago. This is very important, by the way. Look, we live on the internet. I would be nowhere near the audience numbers today if I'd have stayed in commercial radio. We reach hundreds of thousands of people a week, and we can prove it. You see, this is the wonderful thing about analytics online. You have a name. You're very, very well known already. You just need to blog on your own website and write and say whatever you want, and you will be stunned at the readership numbers that you get through your own site, and that can be monetized. This is not bullshit now. It's very easy for a guy like you who's already established to do that, and you can do it in a way, of course, where you can say what and how you like, when you like, and you don't have to worry about the sort of garbage that you had to put up with over the last few weeks, Kevin. I mean, it's a brave new world for independent journalism. It really is.
Yeah, but the thing is, I'm not a businessman. I'm not very good at creating the kind of business structures and the energy that's necessary to do what you're talking about. I know you mentioned it to me all those weeks. And I have to tell you, Richie, you very kindly asked me to come on air. And I said, no, Richie, I might do myself my career more damage, because I really didn't know my career was over. But it's over. So I came on air with you today because I don't give a flying fig about the consequences of what I say. It really doesn't matter now. It's, you know, they have destroyed me. But in destroying me, they've destroyed their own way of life, that thing called journalism. It's over. It's you know, you can see it withering on the vine. And you might be right. Maybe I should be blogging. At the moment, I'm working on a couple of books so that I find use for my time. I'll always find use for my time. I write anyway because it's therapeutic and it's the way I exercise my brain. And one of the things I've learned over the last three months is that newspapers peddle in lies. News bulletins on radio and television peddle in lies. They told lies about me. They were verifiably lies, so they nonetheless told lies. And so I say to myself whenever I hear a news bulletin by accident, well, how much of what I'm hearing is new is actually deliberate falsehood? And newspaper articles, how many of those are deliberately false or just lazily imbibed some half-digested meme from the internet, and that finds its way and becomes a fact because it's repeated by one journalist who picks up another journalist, and so on and so forth. It's a mutually reinforcing circle of moral and intellectual death, and you can't get much from that. There's not much nourishment to be acquired that way. So, you know, I wonder now about many of my columns, how much of those columns was based on false information, on stuff that I had unwittingly assimilated. I don't know, Richie. This year is coming to its end. Another year starts in 3 weeks' time or something. And you and I will be talking, I hope, in the new year. And I'll happily receive any professional advice I get from you then. But thank you very much for giving me the hospitality of your airwaves today.
Kevin, it was a real pleasure to have you on. We had a lot of tweets from people during the conversation. A lot of people are stunned to hear a very, very famous journalist saying the things that you've been saying. And they're happy to hear it. You know, a lot of our audience, Kevin, they've been feeling this way for a long time and nobody's listening to them. They're hearing it tonight. They're happy to hear it coming from you. Obviously, one or two of our listeners, because they'd be, I suppose, sympathetic to my opinions on Palestine, they're waving their fist at you. But that's a wonderful thing. You see, this is the wonderful thing about independent and free media. People get to speak and say what they want to say without being bullied by presenters or shouted down. And then the audience is left up to their own devices to make their own mind up. This is what I used to do many years ago when I started off in radio. Kevin, I think you're terrific. Your books are brilliant, mate. I do hope you come back on the programme in the new year, and my word is gold. I'll be able to put you in touch with people who will be able to very, very quickly and very efficiently set you up with a site where you can write articles whenever you want to. Look, we'll talk about that in the new year. Sorry what happened to you. I'm not surprised it happened to you, but it's not going to stop you, Kevin. You're 70 years old, you're not 100. There's still plenty of life left in Kevin Myers.
I'm 70 doesn't mean anything anymore. I'm not dead.
You're not dead,
one form of my existence has come to an end. But that's by the by. Kevin Myers lives on. I just haven't found what form in which Kevin Myers is going to continue living. But that form is not going to be limited by my age, which I profess to ignore completely.
Listen, enjoy your Christmas. The best of luck to you over the Christmas and to your wife.
Richie, happy Christmas to you and all your listeners.
Thank you very much, Kevin. It was a great pleasure. Kevin Myers, Irish journalist and author, live on the line to us there from Ireland. Incredibly candid and honest about what happened over the last few weeks to him after being fired from the Sunday Times for absolutely no good reason because of a thought-provoking, funny, he says, you know, maybe not the best written article. I would disagree with that. Amazing stuff. We're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap up.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
Book launches are often hyped. Then you open the first page and... But David Icke's new book, Everything You Need to Know But Have Never Been Told, really will astonish you. Thought-provoking and controversial. It's available now, so read a real page-turner. Everything You Need to Know But Have Never Been Told by former footballer and presenter David Icke. Available exclusively at davidicke.com.
Is your mind full of ideas, yet you struggle to put them down on paper?
Characters with no home, unfinished concepts that you always wanted to finalise,
yet lacked knowledge and drive to complete? The Creative Writing Course from Creative Imaginings
may be the long-awaited answer, designed to help you finish your masterpiece
with better language techniques, detailed study of the character, plotted suspense chain, and
valuable information to get published.
Don't delay your creation. Complete your 100% online course at www.creativeimaginings.com.au.
Right, that's more or less it for the programme. We have one or two progressives amongst our audience. One or two people are annoyed that Kevin was saying those things about Israel. Don't be progressive. Grow up. Grow up and get used to listening to somebody saying something you don't agree with. You know what my opinion is on the Zionist occupied government of Washington of the United States. You know what my opinion of Israel is. It is a tyrannical, apartheid, brutal, murderous state. I don't have to keep saying it. I don't have to keep jumping down people's throats to argue with them. We weren't on to talk about Palestine and Israel. We've got to get used to hearing things from people that we don't agree with. Isn't it wonderful? Don't be like the progressives, throwing your ties out of the pram and shitting the bed because you heard somebody say he's pro-Israel. Grow up. You know who you are. Grow up. Jesus Christ. It's not as if I haven't had people on regularly who disagree with me and you. It's what it's all about. It's why we do what we do. And I'm not virtue signalling. Kevin Myers is amazing. Really enjoyed Paul Craig Roberts in the first hour as well. That's it for the week's programmes. I'll be back with you Sunday morning live for Sunday View at 11 a.m. UK time. It's 11 a.m. UK time on Sunday morning for Sunday View. Stay in touch with davidicke.com, with fabradiointernational.com as well. Big shout out to Simon Stewart for looking after YouTube, and Jean-Anne Crowley, who made the interview with Kevin Myers possible. Thank you, Jean-Anne. Have a fabulous next few days and weekend. Speak to you on Sunday. Bye for now. Bye.